At Beer and Bomb and Spean PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birnbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Hynten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Hynten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
How healthy is your business? Is your business plan helping your bottom line? Do you even have a business plan? Barbara Haggerty of Mind Your Own Business has over 25 years of helping businesses of all kinds and sizes to get them where their owners want them to go. She uses her special wellness check process. It's to assess where your business is now, and then uses her own unique 7-steps business excellence plan to expand and grow your business into something to be proud of. Barbara will take a holistic or a global appreciation view of your company, and that's absolutely going to make a difference to your bottom line. So call now and schedule a wellness check and watch your business grow. 602-750-4518. That's Barbara Haggerty of Mind Your Own Business. 602-750-4518.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. If it is the second Tuesday of the month from 3 to 4, of course, it is Understanding Autism, starring Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon. Guys, how are you?
Doing good.
Doing well.
You had a great show yesterday.
Thank you.
Yeah, yesterday we had Gail Noble, author of Breathe, a book full of tips for parents dealing with the stresses of raising an autistic child.
And that's got to be stressful, right?
You know, I would think so. And the parents I've worked with, and you know, I mean, I'm sure all parents have varying degrees of stress. But when you have a child, no matter what age they are, that has a chronic disability that there is no cure for, I mean, it's very wearing on both the individual and their family. Absolutely. But she had some great tips to offer.
I know. So. I heard the show.
I know. We missed you on your birthday.
I know. I wasn't here. Can you believe it?
Yeah, actually, we didn't notice, actually.
Oh, yeah. And Tom's cheering like, oh, thank God he's not here.
Well, you heard we got three rounds of applause from Tom yesterday. That's a little...
I know. That's a record-breaking day.
And how funny. You weren't here for that.
Yeah, what is going on around here?
Just kidding. We
missed behave, you. Austin Powers used to say, or something. Now, if you want to see this on Ustream, go to familyvaluesradio.net until we... get a certain website back up. It's under examination right now. I don't know. What's the word, Paul? Under scrutiny. Know. No, it's being
fixed.
It's being repaired.
Resurrected.
They're, yeah, that's a better one. We should have a vote on what we want to call it. But go to familyvaluesradio.net and see it. Listen or see it. I mean, you could do it either way. So the station has a great website as well. Okay. Yes, Kim.
I just wanted to make sure if you could give that information out one more time, just in case somebody's now grabbing a pen.
Okay, grab a pen. FamilyValuesRadio.net. FamilyValuesRadio.net. You can't get better than that. Family values, right?
Absolutely.
And then you add .net. How easy is that? Pretty easy. Okay, so what do we got for today's action?
Well, Paul and I are here to, of course, have a sort of a part two to last month's episode of co-occurring conditions that often come alongside the autism. I just wanted to introduce my co-host, though, to listeners who are just now tuning in or maybe first time hearing, understanding autism. We have my co-host, Paul Loudon. He is 28 years old. And he was diagnosed with Asperger's at the age of 23. And he comes all the way out here from Houston to support, you know, the spread of information on autism spectrum disorders and to help clarify some of the misunderstandings that are floating around out there. So I'm really thankful to have him as a co-host.
And Kim, of course, is an RDI consultant who has been working with people on the autism spectrum for 15 years now and just wants to help use her in-depth knowledge to spread understanding.
Thank you.
That was like Donnie and Marie. That was great how you went back and forth. Remember that show? Okay, you don't. All right, you guys are too young. I like Donnie and Marie. Okay, I'm turning my man card in. All right, so co-occurring, that's what they... That was a good one, right?
I don't even know what a man card is.
I don't either, but...
It's a secret.
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yeah, what can
I'm
I say?
I'm outnumbered.
I'm just kidding.
All right.
Now, co-occurring...
So back to autism.
Yes, co-occurring conditions. I remember that show a couple months back.
Yeah, you know, in fact, for listeners who didn't hear last month's show... Actually, when Break Radio Show's site is back up, you can go back and listen to the archived, version of last month's show, which we talked about co-occurring conditions related to biomedical conditions that come alongside autism, and also things like anxiety, ADD, sort of more psychological conditions that run alongside autism. And today we were going to talk about two co-occurring conditions in particular that actually occur with a very high frequency and are misunderstood or actually clumped in to the diagnosis of autism itself, which is people who have autism who have speech impairments as well as motor impairments or motor delays. And a lot of times those kinds of very profound symptoms are easily interpreted as the autism themselves. So a lot of times you hear people say that, you know, my child with autism either doesn't speak or has very limited language. And then a lot of times professionals, too, clump that into the autism diagnosis when actually it's not necessarily part of the autism. It's a speech condition that will run alongside autism. And what's been found is that for many people on the spectrum, co-occurring conditions actually occur at a very high frequency, so which is why you hear about many people who have autism have biomedical problems, you know, GI problems, anxiety, attention deficit disorder, things like that. There's a high frequency if a person has autism to also have those things. So today we were going to talk about the co-occurring conditions of speech delay or speech problems and motor problems.
And I guess one important thing, again, to repeat, is that these conditions aren't autism. They come with it, but when you're treating autism, if they have these conditions, you also need to be looking at a way to treat or deal with them, because just resolving the autistic part of the equation is not necessarily going to help with the other difficulties the child or person is having.
And that's a really important point, because in order to clearly help someone in a particular area, you have to define it very clearly. And that's one of the challenges with autism, because it is a spectrum. And there are some commonalities, though, despite what might be called the low end, the high end of the spectrum. There are a set of commonalities that involve mental processes that really make up the core deficits of autism. So things like being able to, I'm going to put this in very plain type terms, but being able to read people, understand emotional intent, communicative intent, also using more flexible language and experience sharing language is also a core deficit across the spectrum. So regardless of speech, you know, motor functioning, IQ, those kinds of core processes are what actually defines the autism itself, is those core processes. And then along with that, you can have, you know, many people also aren't able to speak and they have autism. But, you know, you can have a speech problem and not have autism. You can have a speech delay and not have autism. You could have motor functioning problems and not have autism. So it's important when you're looking at your child or your loved one, whoever you're thinking of, whether you have an autism diagnosis or not, you know, in an individual, obviously, there's the person and their personality. If they have autism, there's their core deficits of autism. And if they have co-occurring conditions, those are things to look at, such as the biomedical side, speech, communication, motor problems, other types of psychological, you know, difficulties, whether it's depression or anxiety. So today, we're going to talk about specifically the speech and the motor side of co-occurring conditions.
So speech and the motor side.
Yeah.
So how does... What would that include? Why don't you start with speech? And is that a whole range of things?
Absolutely, it can be. Some people who have autism, they don't develop speech until much later in life, developmentally, than they should. Some people don't develop speech at all, actually. And a lot of times, because that is such a concrete symptom, and it startles people and it concerns people, thinking, well, if this child can't talk, this is serious, but not even realizing that there are actually lots of processes involved with speech versus, you know, even functional use of speech is actually another speech problem. Because sometimes I'll have people that I work with who they are able to speak, but it's really not functional. It's repetitive. And it doesn't really have a direct meaning or an understandable meaning. I'm sure to the person it means something, but it's completely not understandable to everybody around them. And also just a very limited use of speech, where some people with autism will tend to communicate verbally only for things that they need in an immediate sense. So, you know, like when you think of typical kids, maybe they see something cool outside, like a butterfly or a flower, you know, I'm thinking of like a toddler, and they're like, "Mama, look." You know, and they're communicating because they want their mom to see the thing that they're seeing, and they want to know what mom thinks about that. So communicating for sharing purposes versus I need juice or I need water, you know, so a matter of how a person uses their language, too, because there's a matter of using speech to get what you need sort of in an instrumental way. And then there's also experience sharing language, which is often impaired to varying degrees in people with autism. So using speech actually as an enhancement to an interaction versus as the interaction itself or like a transaction.
Now, can that be subjective? I mean, are there on the borderline where there's some people that, let's say for the assumption they don't have autism, but they either don't know the skills, having the skill set to have good interaction, or perhaps they're shy, or they have some fear of interaction. So how do you know when it's a borderline situation?
Well, I mean, that's sort of the key, is that these speech difficulties aren't autism. And so when you're diagnosing autism, you may take note of them, but what you're looking with the diagnosis are the core deficits. Whether or not someone has speech difficulties, you still are just want to focus on the core deficits. And if they're there, they're autistic. If they're not there, they're not. Independently of any of the other co-occurring conditions, which, I mean, it's like saying so many diseases come with fevers. But you don't look at whether they have a fever necessarily as a key to diagnosis, except that if they don't have a fever, then they probably don't have one of these. You look at blood tests or mouth swabs or all the other things that you put together.
Hmm. And when it comes to speech, I guess the examples, too, that I was giving – and maybe I didn't clarify this as well, but I'm glad Paul brought this sort of to a nice summation here, is a person, the way they speak and their intentions when they speak is reflective of their thought processes. So I think there's separate things. There are people who actually physically, they cannot speak, which may mean they have some kind of brain damage. A lot of times when I've worked with people who aren't able to speak and they have autism, they also have some kind of seizure disorder going on, or, you know, something which is another co-occurring condition that is preventing that part of their brain from being able to actually physically speak. But then there are speech disorders that are related to the thought processes of autism. So when you hear more like rigid speech or concrete speech without a lot of flexibility, that would raise a question mark in my mind. But I guess the point is, you really have to pay attention to, you know, obviously the physical symptoms, but also make connections between what those symptoms mean from a thought standpoint and when they're occurring, and examine the why and not just assume to clump them into, you know, a particular disorder. Although with speech disorders too, and autism, a lot of children, they tend to have, you know, different kind. There's a whole range, and a speech pathologist would probably be better at describing some of those things. But they have many speech problems in addition to some of that rigidity and concrete type speaking and all of that. But it is considered. It's not really the speech itself. Is not part of the autism. The way the speech is maybe communicated reflects the thinking, but whether a person has language or not language is actually not part of autism itself.
And when we come back from our break, we'll continue our discussion with Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon. This is Understanding Autism. We're talking about co-occurring conditions. Sounds very important to really be able to recognize any symptoms. Doesn't necessarily mean you're on the spectrum, but nevertheless, it's good to have more information to understand who you're dealing with, and we'll be right back.
How healthy is your business? Is your business plan helping your bottom line? Do you even have a business plan? Barbara Haggerty of Mind Your Own Business has over 25 years of helping businesses of all kinds and sizes to get them where their owners want them to go. She uses her special wellness check process. It's to assess where your business is now, and then uses her own unique 7-steps business excellence plan to expand and grow your business into something to be proud of. Barbara will take a holistic or a global appreciation view of your company, and that's absolutely going to make a difference to your bottom line. So call now and schedule a wellness check and watch your business grow. 602-750-4518. That's Barbara Haggerty of Mind Your Own Business. 602-750-4518.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is Understanding Autism, starring Kimberly Isaac and Paul Alden, all the way from Texas. Hey, by the way, Paul, how was your flight?
Delayed 2 hours, but
no
delayed
way.
Because of rain, so we're pretty happy about that.
Where was it raining?
Houston. All over the place.
Wow, any hurricanes out there?
Not that I know of, but...
No. But rain. It
rain.
Does get rain out there, doesn't it?
Well, we've had a drought for the last forever or so, so you
really?
Know.
Dad, like
our
most of
state
Texas
has
is
been on
fire
since November last year. I mean,
more
of our state has burnt than I think Connecticut, like the entire area of Connecticut.
Really?
Yeah, no, it's been bad. You wake up mornings and you smell smoke and you're just like, the air is smoky today. I can't breathe.
It's been pretty bad. Yeah.
But we had a lot of rain. I think it rained for about 6 hours, which was pretty good.
Wow, that's a lot of
rain.
They
really needed it. It's very dry.
Well, that's
there.
Good. It took out the fires then.
Hopefully
dry.
Some of them.
So.
Wow. So they're still burning out of control?
I think most of them are somewhat under control, but there's always new ones with the drought. You know, a spark here and suddenly a huge new fire. So.
Oh, man. All right, back to Kim.
Yeah, so, sort of, but what we've been talking about is co-occurring conditions, and I think one important thing to talk about is the speech difficulties is what we've been talking about so far, and one of the major issues with speech therapies is that speech difficulties is that you are dealing with autism, and autism is sort of a social issue. You have difficulty expressing your feelings or interacting with feelings, understanding them, reacting to them. And if you don't have the tools of speech available, then you're in a much more difficult situation for directing. I mean, if you think about yourself and not being able to speak, that's difficult. But you can make signs, you can draw words or something. If you take out the fact that you're also not able to understand the people around you well and understand what they're saying to you effectively, then the lack of speech becomes much more of an impediment than it would be otherwise.
You're right, because I think, when it comes to autism, some of the impediment is related to picking up so many of the other communication channels, which is like, you know, reading people, being able to understand some of their facial expressions, even their body positioning and stuff like that. And so having autism and then having a speech or communication problem on top of that makes it much more frustrating a lot of times for the person who's affected and obviously their families as well. And, you know, there are a lot of good speech pathologists out there who are really good at working on speech and improving actual speech, like the words themselves. And what I've seen happen is while the speech improves, because they're working on the speech, a person that has autism and a speech disorder, their speech will still be reflected by the thought processes they're having. So that's when a lot of times you'll see a very sort of rigid use of speech or language, less flexibly, a lot less sharing. And partially because when a student goes into speech therapy, a lot of speech therapists really focus on teaching the child how to communicate needs as a motivator, as just a life motivator. I need water. You know, I have to go to the bathroom. I want a snack. Those are some of the basic or things that they like. I want a sticker. But it's always a means to an end type instruction. And what's tricky is for a person that has autism who already has difficulty sharing perspectives, they don't necessarily always have the language to actually use it for sharing purposes and relational purposes. So they learn, I know how to get what I want, but that doesn't always help when it comes to friendships and, you know, trying to relate to others in a social setting. Because then you put some of these kids in a social setting and they don't really know what to say to each other.
So it sounds like what you're talking about, if you break it down, if you break speech down, really what it means, there's an input and an output. And the output you might be talking about might be a little bit more mechanical, but it's a reflection of the input of how you process the world and some of the mental processes
of connecting the dots and really sort of cognitive behavior, I guess, or thinking, I should say. So the autism part, I suspect, is the core deficit is on the mental processes, not the mechanical speech part.
Right. And so, you know, I think that's where, you know, again, to even people maybe who are listening that are either in speech therapy or have their kids in speech therapy, it's a great thing. It really is. But it's also important to remember that there's so much more to language than just verbal language, because that's another sort of, I want to say, myth that parents have is I'll send my child to speech therapy and they can talk now. Everything's going to be just fine. Now, it does help when you have a child that talks. Obviously, you have a clue as to what's going on for them and what they need. But what a lot of times ends up happening is they don't know how to use their speech functionally and to relate to other people. And so that it becomes tricky. And it's very frustrating because now you have a person that you know can speak. But why aren't they doing it? Why aren't they speaking in a flexible, you know, quote unquote, normal way? But basically, in those cases, these kids, they've been taught to speak, but the processes that they have that are, you know, that are rolling, coming before the speech, are just reflective of what they understand.
And that's kind of why it's important to separate these co-occurring conditions from the core deficits, is because if people start thinking about the speech as being one of the core problems, then they're like, well, I'm treating this, my kid is getting better, but what you're improving is not necessarily the thing that really needs the hard focus.
Right. And that's why balance is so important, because there's a lot of people, they do need speech therapy. That's so valid. But it really can't, for a person that needs speech therapy and has autism, the speech therapy isn't treating the autism. And I think that's where I've seen in my experience, a lot of families will say, oh, speech therapy has, you know, he's doing so much better. And I'm always like, well, I'm a person who's like, well, what does that mean to be so much better? What do you mean by that? And what it comes down to is, yes, his speech is so much better, which is wonderful. And that's great. But it's important to also have balance in your therapies and realize that that's one aspect of something your child needed help with. And not to ignore, you know, the cognitive processing side, you know, and just treat the physical symptoms. Because I guarantee, no matter how old they are, it will come back later on, particularly in middle school and high school, when the social scene is just, it's a whole different ballgame. The little ones can sort of wean, you know, they can get by in school with that kind of language. But once you get, you know, into the higher education, they become often very lost and isolated socially, because they haven't been evolving along with their peers in that social way.
So I think what you're saying is parents, as well as anyone working with someone on the spectrum, they should really have a well-defined set of criteria, what it means that when something's better, and also outcome measures. Do you deal with that?
Yeah. I mean, it's very tricky, because with things like speech or, you know, actual motor skills, you can have very clear data. Very clear data. I mean, you can say, okay, I'm going to teach this child to express his wants. And if he can do that, you know, 8 out of 10 times, okay, he's meeting his goal. When it comes to mental processes, you can sort of track it that way, but that's not really what you're after. You're looking at the quality of life, the quality of interactions that the student is having with friends, parents, you know, all of that stuff. There are objectives, like social emotional objectives, but they can't be quantified into numbers as concretely as some of those other things can be.
And even then, it's also just very hard to gauge progress on something like that, because, you know, you have to deal with what they're experiencing. And obviously, one of the difficulties is them expressing what they're experiencing. So you have to look at what they're doing and decide whether you think that's better or not. And then, when possible, get feedback back from them. But it's a very fuzzy process. It's like looking through, you know, something that's out of focus and trying to figure out what's going on there. Sometimes you're guessing, sometimes you're right, sometimes you're wrong. If you have enough information, you have a good idea what's going on, but you're never going to have an exact grasp of what you're seeing through that out of focus lens.
Right. I mean, it's definitely not 100%, but what's great about once a person really learns about what the core deficits are, and people learn to be good observers of their children or their students, you know, whoever they're actually dealing with, you can actually learn over time to watch a person's eye movements and the way they move their body to see how they're processing things. And that's something that I teach parents to do as part of what I do. But also, it is hard because you don't know exactly what someone's thinking, but you can watch where they put their attention and how they direct their own thoughts and, you know, take themselves places. And once you learn about the core deficits in great detail and you understand all how all this processing stuff works, you can have a sense of, are they being more dynamic in this case or more static? Static meaning sort of more inflexible or concrete, I guess, and dynamic, more fluid and free-flowing. And so in autism, static thinking is one of the big problems, you know, because dynamic thinking requires a lot of flexible shifting in your attention, you know, shifting and also sort of packaging of information. So like if I'm watching the head honcho over there take his notes while I talk, and I'm watching him, and I'm watching his face, and I'm watching his nonverbal, and sometimes his eyes go here, and I'm putting it all together to sort of interpret what maybe he's thinking.
And what are you interpreting right now?
I don't want to say.
And when we come back from our break, I'm going to tell you exactly what I was writing down, because you're going to like that. Yes, I haven't said it in months, but it is neuro-linguistic programming. And when we come back, I'm going to explain how this is so similar to what you're talking about, nonverbal communication. We call it eye accessing cues. Behavioral flexibility is the key to really helping out people, and I'll explain that when we come back.
Ridenour, Hynten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Hynten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is Understanding Autism. We've been talking about co-occurring conditions, particularly speech right now. And, of course, Kim, you were saying just before the break, you can also determine what people are, maybe how they're reacting, what they're thinking, their processes by eye movements. And
not determine, analyze and
analyze.
Evaluate.
There we go. See? Paul, she corrected the situation. I didn't say me, but she corrected the situation. In NLP, it might be similar, eye accessing cues. You can actually tell how people are processing the world by where their eyes are as they're thinking. For example, maybe this is similar to what you have learned, is if you're looking up, you're processing visually and looking to side to side, it's auditorily. Looking down to the right, typically, is kinesthetically. You're into your feeling state. So it is interesting that there are some signs on how people process what they're thinking at a certain point. At least the process is part of it. And the nonverbal part is very important, because if you get really good at nonverbal, you can really start to look at patterns, how people react. You can almost determine how they're going to react to certain situation. Now, you said flexibility. I totally agree with you. Behavioral flexibility is very important. And the more ways you can achieve something, the better. And most people have one way, two ways. That's it. Kim, I think what you do is you provide different tools, mean flexibility to be able to understand and to process in ways that might have better outcomes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. You said that very nicely, by the way. You did.
How was that, Paul?
Yeah.
It was fine.
I give you props. I do have an interesting example, though, of this nonverbal communication. People don't even I don't even know what people think of when they initially hear nonverbal, but I'll tell you, it's faces, it's subtle body movements, it's posture, it's, you know,
head nods.
Heads. I mean, it's so much stuff. It's not just, okay, I'm not talking. How
it's
am I communicating?
Breathing.
It's everything.
It's how.
It's,
the how.
It's very interesting. But I have to tell you, so I was working with one of my teenage boys, and he would literally ask me things that were, the answers were obviously visually in front of him. So, for example, like, okay, let's say we went to, like, McDonald's or something, and I ordered a hamburger, and he was looking right at me. I was holding my meal, and he said, "So what did you order?" And I looked down, and I looked at him, and he absolutely could not make that connection that, well, I'm showing, you know, I was kind of like, hello, you know, it's right here. And it made me really realize that, you know, I wasn't actually intending to be nonverbal in that moment. That was just the reality of holding what I had just ordered. He saw me order it. He saw me receive it. Anyway, so I thought, wow, he really didn't realize that he can gain information through watching. He was so used to asking and getting an answer that he automatically went to that level. So we started playing these kind of playful games. Like I would say, okay, I'm going to show you, I'm not going to talk with my mouth, I'm going to talk with my body, and I want you to watch and tell me what you think I'm trying to say. So I kind of did some different things, and I had hunched over at one point, like hunched over and kind of put my head down a little bit to show I was tired and weary. And he goes, "Oh, your back hurts." And I said, interesting, you know, but hearing his perspective, what he was seeing when I was trying to show was a really good reminder for me on all the things that I would assume that he's noticing and reading about me and just thinking that it's getting in there and moving forward when there were a lot of things he really wasn't noticing. So a lot of times, I mean, since then, when I'm with him, I always point out for him to watch. I'm not going to tell you, I'm going to show you. You know, because he's literally walking by people with some things that are actually real obvious. I'm not even talking about the subtle things. But so many times has that happened where, you know, we go places together and I'll order a smoothie. And he's standing there with me. And he'll order and I'll order. And I'll say, yes, I want a strawberry smoothie. And then I have it in my hand. And 5 minutes later, he'll look at me drinking. What did you order? Or did you order a drink? I mean, something really obvious. And I'll do like this and I'll show him, you know. But it just... What's interesting to me is that I think people take speech and they consider it to be, they label speech as communication. Like if somebody can speak, that's all they need.
And I think I've sort of touched on that before with, to me, there's three channels of communication. And speech, the words, just literally the words, not how they're said, not the speed they're said at, not the volume, but what they mean, if you look them up in a dictionary, is to me verbal communication. And then nonverbal explicit communication is everything else you do, your body language, the tone, how you're stanced. It's all stuff that you intend the other person to pick up. You may be doing it subconsciously or you may not, but it's all stuff that you do for the other person to pick up. You may widen your eyes, not realize it, but you want them to see that. And then the third part of communication is sort of the stuff that's not said, everything else. I actually have a show I want to do on that later. I think we were talking about December, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty big topic, but there's this whole area out there of the part of communication that isn't there while you're communicating. And So I'll get to that later, but that's the thing, is communication is a lot bigger than people usually give thought to. And when they're breaking it down, they usually forget one part or another. You know, there's the parts of it that you can teach, and there are parts of it that you can't really teach in a direct process. And unfortunately, a lot of the people on the spectrum are most responsive to the bits they're being directly taught. That they learn things, they learn them as patterns, as set in stone things. You know, if someone hunches their shoulders, it means this. Or it may mean this list of things, but they don't necessarily have the tools to expand and go, what else could it mean based on this other information I've got?
That totally makes sense.
And because of that, and that brings up a really good point, and something we do in RDI is we take, you know, obviously as many situations as we can that aren't directly, I guess you could say, taught, but learned through experience, and we break some of those things down. And you think, we do a lot of comparing to, like, typical development. So it's like, wait, we never really tell babies, you know, when you think about the process, their job in life for the first several years is just to observe others. They watch how people, they just look. They can't do anything. They can't even crawl. They can't even talk. They're watching. And in their brains, you know, in a typically developing brain at that young age, they're taking what they're observing and they're starting to form connections. And they're starting to form those patterns nonverbally, all of those things. They're just sort of taking note. They still don't know what it means or what to do with it, but they're starting to take note. Now, a baby that is developing in a non-typical way, or a baby that has autism, may be watching things, but they're not the things that a typical baby's watching. They might, and I've seen a lot of videos, like the baby who has autism might be staring at this red sticker dot, you know, on the shelf here, when the typical baby's watching the parent and studying. So what the two babies are studying are very different. So the connections they're making, you can see that the baby who's developing typically is really focused on analyzing the people. And the baby who has the autism is really focused on the items, you know, for the most part. And so over time, though, as a child develops from whichever point they start, you know, that's what they learn is important and relevant. And that's what they focus on, and that's what they communicate about, and that, you know, all that sort of thing. So I don't know how we got over to this, the communication.
Well, verbal leads to communication.
The verbal, right.
We were talking about, you know, if you're trying to teach someone verbal skills,
right,
you aren't teaching them communication so much, right, as you're teaching them a list of words and their meanings.
Right. And so that's why it is really important to, first of all, view communication as a very wide package of stuff. It's not just, if my child can talk, they're a communicator. That's really not the case. And it's important to really to slow down and even ask yourself as a person, you know, there's so many subtle things that we don't even realize that we're doing, you know, and it's important to just think, well, yeah, what am I conveying? Sometimes with someone's body language, they may be giving someone, you know, a communication they weren't even intending to, you know, so just sort of paying attention to how you communicate yourself is going to be helpful in how you interact with your kids, because you're going to be more aware.
Well, I'm going to let's take a quick break, but I want to have you contemplate what I'm going to say right now. So when we come back from the break, you'll be all ready to respond. The meaning of communication is the response you get. Think about that. The meaning of communication is the response you get. Think about what that could mean, how it could help, and we'll be right back.
How healthy is your business? Is your business plan helping your bottom line? Do you even have a business plan? Barbara Haggerty of Mind Your Own Business has over 25 years of helping businesses of all kinds and sizes to get them where their owners want them to go. She uses her special wellness check process. It's to assess where your business is now, and then uses her own unique 7 steps business excellence plan to expand and grow your business into something to be proud of. Barbara will take a holistic or a global appreciation view of your company, and that's absolutely going to make a difference to your bottom line. So call now and schedule a wellness check and watch your business grow. 602-750-4518. That's Barbara Haggerty of Mind Your Own Business, 602-750-4518.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is Understanding Autism, starring Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon, all the way from Houston, Texas, where it evidently is raining. Maybe it dried up.
It's been a couple days, but it'd be nice if it was still raining.
Yeah, although as long as it doesn't affect your flight tomorrow.
Oh, that's right.
There is that, yeah.
Yeah, you don't want that to happen. So what I had you contemplate, the meaning of communication is the response you get. And I know you both were really contemplating this, the break. The meaning of communication is the response you get. Not the intention, because everyone can have best intentions, but if you get a different response, you better be able to notice it and have the behavior flexibility to change up your communication to get your messages across. That's what the great psychologists do. Who wants to comment on that?
I would change the wording slightly, actually.
Okay, yes.
The meaning of communication is the response you create. Because what you're trying to do when you're communicating with someone is trigger certain thoughts.
Makes sense.
You are trying to create a response. So while part of it is what they're doing, part of it's what you're doing, and it's sort of shared understanding. Also, as you're communicating, you're watching their response and adapting your communication to it as it goes. It's a process, not a single act. So for me, at least, my perspective is the meaning of communication is the response you create.
Nicely said. I love that.
And actually, on sort of piggybacking on that real fast, what's important for people to realize is typically in autism, that process that Paul described of the watching and changing and the ongoing process of the reciprocal communication is very, very hard for people with autism, generally speaking, to different degrees. Paul has been actively working on it. He's real much more fluid at it probably now than he's ever been. But when you people who are listening out there that have kids of any age, you might be thinking, hey, wait, my kid doesn't do that. Generally, that's a very difficult thing to continuously monitor within an interaction and shift. And I mean, that's the goal. What Paul described as the goal.
Is it teachable?
Yes.
So that's the good news. And Paul, why don't you describe your experience? How, I mean, Kim just mentioned how you were have progressing and moving forward on this. Can you remember a time when you really maybe didn't have a clue what that meant, and now you do? And what happened? What was the process of moving you forward to more what I'd call sensory acuity, really understanding how people react?
Well, I think a lot of us don't really think about how we communicate. It's something that we've grown up with, we've picked up, we talk, we see people respond, we adapt to it. It's a very subconscious thing. When I was diagnosed with Asperger's a few years back, it's 5 years now, wow, almost six.
Hmm. January 12th.
Yes, you got it this time.
I got it. It's his birthday.
When I was diagnosed, and the diagnosis did show up on my birthday, it was kind of in the mail on my birthday.
Happy birthday.
It gave me the tools to look at one of the difficulties I was having being communication, and I started thinking about, you know, paying attention to different things. I knew I needed to pay attention to, but I started doing it consciously. And for me, it's still a very discrete process. I look at someone I'm communicating with, and part of my brain is thinking, oh, she's doing this, she's doing this, maybe it means this, maybe it means this. There's a lot of sort of sub-processes, but it's still not one fluid process. It's a lot of steps for me. But I think the idea is for communication to sort of be a flow, you know, just, you know, you think a computer can break up sound into a bunch of little bits, and when you play it back, it still sounds like sound. But if you look at it, it's a bunch of little bits. And if And that's sort of what we're talking about is for everyone else, it's sound. For me, it's a bunch of little bits that I have to look at individually one at a time. And it takes more time. It takes more energy. Being in a group, communicating with a group in a social context rather than just explaining things to them. Like here on the radio, I'm talking about things. I'm not talking with people so much. It's pretty easy for me. Talking with people tires me out very quickly because it's much more of a conscious process than at least my experience tells me it is for other people. And so it wears me out, but that's sort of where I'm at now is that I can do a lot of the things I should be doing, not as long as I'd like to be able to, not as well as I'd like to be able to, but much better than I used to be able to now that I know that I know what I need to be doing to a degree. I have some idea of what process I was missing before.
And I think what's really important, too, for people who are listening to Paul describe this, especially parents and support people, is, you know, slowing down your own communication is helpful in helping them to process things as they go along. And on the same token, be mindful of it's hard for the individual to slow down for that long, too. So slowing down is actually a very good thing when you're trying to communicate and help someone sort of figure out the process as you go. But also remember that the process is tiring for them. And so you want to, you know, do little bits of productive interactions. You don't want to overdo things and try to, you know, some people think that more is better. Now, technically, at some point, it becomes better. But initially, when people are learning how to slow themselves down to process what's happening within an interaction, you've got to do little steps at a time so they can kind of build up that stamina and grow from there.
So let me ask you, Paul, it sounds like that you were describing it like you have to consciously pay attention to various pieces to what certain things mean. At some point, have you realized that some of it goes unconscious and you can do it unconsciously, or is that still a goal that you have that eventually if you do something long enough, well enough, it might be embedded unconsciously and it's automatic?
You know, some of it, I would say it's automatic. I wouldn't necessarily say it's unconscious so much as I don't have to focus on it. And it's usually people I know well. Once I know someone, I know a lot of what their reactions are going to be or what their reactions mean. I don't have to say, oh, he's scrunching his forehead. I have to try to guess what that means because with them, I've seen that 95% of the time that means he's confused now and I should slow down and go back and see what I missed explaining. You know, that once I know someone, I don't have to put as much work into it. But it doesn't really extrapolate well. It doesn't expand out to new people well. So it doesn't work well for me as a broad strategy yet. It just works. It helps with individuals that I can be around them longer without feeling tired or without feeling confused or using up too much energy.
But it's a nice enhancement you've seen over the years.
I would say it's improved things.
That's good. How would you look at it?
I agree with that. I think on everybody's part, it just requires that deliberate thought and patience. I can't stress that enough. Because sometimes, especially when you have a student, a child, adult child, whatever, who has excellent abilities, you know, IQ, verbal, you know, somebody like Paul, which I see a lot of, you know, a lot of people like that. It's hard to understand why they would be so tired or frustrated interactively when they have so much to offer. You know, it's like you can't spend 5 minutes with Paul and not learn something completely awesome and be like, wow, I never thought of that, you know. But you know, the way we interact in that process where we're taking in a package of communication, the nonverbal, you know, the words, the continuous monitoring, for us it is so much more automatic. And so it's important that people, you know, don't take for granted the fact that, you know, if your, you know, adult child can only, you know, hang out with you for an hour and kind of hang with it, you know, that's good. You know, you have to really be respectful of what their kind of emotional stamina, you know, is because it's not automatic for them. And that's what I think we take for granted. We really have to respect the energy that goes into what the person is, you know, doing to try to pay attention to you.
I'm a master of distraction. So that was good. My fan base is here. They were all walking through and I was multitasking, and that's a nice skill level too. Now, thank you so much. Now,
I mean, I guess one thing I'd sort of compare it with is imagine yourself sitting down and writing an essay for an hour on maybe a topic you know about, but it's still something you have to think about. I mean, that's sort of where I am holding a conversation. It's not something necessarily that's flexible, comfortable, enjoyable for me. I mean, I may enjoy telling people something or seeing their responses, but it's a lot of work as well. So where a conversation might be fine for you, imagine having to sit down and write an essay for that time period if you want to think about what I might be experiencing there.
It's active work versus that automatic, you know, that automatic process. And I can't imagine. I have so much respect for people like Paul, and I actually have a couple of friends who have Asperger's that describe the same way, as how it's such an active, deliberate process for them, just to process what we're taking in without even realizing it. And so the people that make the efforts to slow down and process people and work hard at it, I really have a lot of respect for that. Because some people may just throw their hands up and go, you know what, this is too hard, I'm out. But not Paul.
Would it be similar to someone going to college and they don't have a database in their mind, a reference point, learning a whole new subject, a foreign language or something, where you have to consciously really try to understand it before it hits the unconscious, and that could get tiring. Is that similar?
A foreign language is a good one, just because then you aren't just, you know, if you learn a foreign language, that's one thing. If you go to another country and live with people who speak that language, there's still a whole host of information you don't have. And I would say I'm sort of at the point where I've learned the language and I've been in the country a little while. I'm beginning to pick it up. So it's a beginning is the language, but there's so much more. And when you're there, if they say something to you, you still have to stop and translate in your head to English. It's like, okay, he said whatever he said, and you stop and say, okay, that means the bus stop is five streets over. You know, so there's a built-in delay that you're trying to minimize. And that's sort of what it is you're trying to keep up with everyone while doing this mental process of putting together the information to something you can understand.
Which I just can't imagine how tired. It just sounds to me like here I am receiving feedback from you guys simultaneously. It's completely effortless for me. In fact, I'm like a hyper-referencer, I think. And trying to put myself on the opposite side where it's like, if I had to really watch every little movement, you know, that you make, you know, then I would be like, it would take me so much more time to keep up, which is another reason why I'm a big fan of parents really slowing down and giving a chance for everybody to kind of respond and get on the same page so that the person can actually process what the first thing was you showed or, you know, what you said. But Paul, that's a really good way of putting it, your experience.
Excellent way, and I think that will give insight to people that are experiencing similarities or similar things, as well as people that maybe have never experienced that, but if they can relate to a foreign language, I think it would be difficult. Just drop someone off in the middle of France or Spain or someone without the language, without knowing anyone, that could be a scary feeling. And guess what? We're at the end of the show. How do they get in touch with you guys? You got all the stuff going on Facebook and everything. What is it?
Well, we'd love to hear from you at facebook.com/understandingautismradio. That's the best place to get in contact with us, and our info there can get you to show archives and everything else. We'd love to hear from you.
Yes, and you also can check our Facebook page for previous show information, and there are previous discussions on there, but we would love to hear what you are interested in. We want to know what you want us to talk about. If you have any ideas for future shows or guests, please contact us. We would absolutely love it.
And we'll see you tomorrow. Sports, Breakthrough Sports, 2 to 4. Seth Pollock, our special guest, with a lot of other special guests tomorrow, 2 to 4. See you then.